type of experience as an NDE. St. Teresa of Avila wrote this: I thought I was being carried up to heaven. The first persons I saw there were my mother and father, and such great things happened in so short a time. I wish I could give a description of at least the smallest part of what I learned, but when I try to discover a way of doing so, I find it impossible. For while the light we see here and that other light are both light, there is no comparison between the two, and the brightness of the sun seems quite dull if compared with the other. I was left with little fear of death from then on. If anyone knows anything about Teresa of Avila, she was not a granola head. She was a pretty well-anchored lady who was really, you know, in charge of various novices, but part of the Carmelite mystics, the Spanish mystics that were deep into contemplative experiences. Other people will speak of God as a dark light. We get those kinds of experiences in these NDEs where they experience in this darkness what we would many times be fearful about, quite the opposite, as a welcoming place, as a place of safety and security, and they feel a loving kind of embrace, even if they don't necessarily. Not everybody, by the way, sees or has all these elements of the near-death experience. These are classic things we've talked about. Some people will only have a sense of maybe seeing a light. Others may have a sense of a welcoming darkness. Others will have a very deep experience. Well, they'll go over and see, well, as I said before, their life review. They may have a deep encounter with spiritual reality, what they think is God, or some will say, I've met Jesus, and things of that nature, which again have a very profound transforming effect. Now, counter explanations of this, well, it's due to drugs. Well, the problem with that is most of the folks didn't have these when they were on drugs. These were as a result of either accident, or cardiac arrest, or some kind of sudden trauma in their lives. Also, it seems that drugs tend to blunt the memory of these experiences. Many people may have them, but they forget them because the drugs interfere with their capacity to somehow relay that. No one really knows for sure why that is. The other thing is not everybody has these. If this were just a brain phenomenon, we'd expect everybody to have something similar who go through similar experiences. And no one knows why that is. Some people have them, some don't, we don't know. One of the things they all come away with, though, is I got what I needed. People seem to experience what they need to experience for their lives to take a certain direction. I met a woman, Nancy Evans Bush. Nancy was head of the International Association of Near-Death Studies. Very long name. And I was talking to her because she was a Connecticut resident for a long time. She's since moved to North Carolina. I saw her again this year out in Arizona. And she had a negative or a distressing experience. For her, it was hard for her to integrate that into her experience. So what she did, she was a UCC Congregationalist. Her father was a minister. And her whole family came from a long line of Congregationalist ministers. She delved into the Catholic mystics, which I thought was kind of neat. And she said, and as she went through that, and she went through the great stories of great heroes of faith, she understood there's something going on in her life, that the distressing experience she had for her was about her having to grow in a way that other people had a different kind of experience for their growth. People who have attempted suicide, you would think, what kind of experience would they have necessarily? A negative one, right? You would expect a distressing. Well, some of them don't. Some have this glorious, illuminated experience. Why? Because they needed that. They needed to be shown that their life had value, and they're not supposed to do that. That's as clear as a bell. That people who attempt suicide and they come back, have been, they know you're not supposed to do that. That whatever issues you have here, you need to try to resolve here. You don't run away from this. You don't get away from that. You still have to deal with it. So life is a gift. We're supposed to see it as such. Yet at the same time, we know so many people who do attempt are psychologically in deep distress and may be ill on a number of levels. But to a person, they come back and say, you're not supposed to do that. Okay. Drug effects, we talked about lack of oxygen to the brain, that doesn't seem to work either. Lack of oxygen to the brain would actually dull or confuse an experience rather than make it clear and coherent. These are, I don't know how to put it, more real than what we're doing right now. If you talk to anybody, they will tell you that this is hyper-reality. It is more clear, it is more focused, and it's more real than this experience we're having right now. Now, for us, this is reality. For them, this is not really the thing. This is a way to there. It's a lower level of being as they see it. Okay? No one's been able to locate in the brain where this all takes place either. That's one of the things we don't know, is where are thoughts stored? No one knows. There are certain parts of the brain that obviously trigger certain thoughts, but generally speaking, nobody knows where the thoughts are. So there's a growing consensus today that the human mind is what we call non-local. It's not located simply in the brain, but in a transcendent realm that interacts with the brain. I'll leave that for you to think about. What do we make of all this? Is this proof of anything? I wouldn't say so. I don't like the word proof. Proof seems to say, okay, it's beyond a shadow of a doubt. We can all go home. We've done a good day's work. There's an interesting book that came out recently called Evidence of the Afterlife. I always love when they put that stuff. The Science of Near-Death Experience, the largest NDE study ever conducted, reveals proof of life after death. All right, well, I'm not from Missouri, but the word proof is a strong word. It means that beyond a shadow of a doubt, now you can garner extraordinary evidence, as these people have in this study, to suggest that that's an extreme possibility. But we don't know for sure if that means eternal. It doesn't. It is, in a sense, inconclusive as to what's the final end of it all. You see? And that's what takes us to the resurrection of Jesus. We're talking about a different order of experience with the resurrection of Jesus. And I wanted to bring that up because this is after all the Easter season. And we've just celebrated the resurrection of Jesus. And it is really the cornerstone of our Christian faith. We know that without Easter, it ends with Good Friday. And then where are we left with that? But Easter is of a nature which, in a sense, revolutionized our concept of God, per se. It overturned people's expectations about what kind of messiahship, what kind of messiah would come for the early church, and it certainly stands the world on its head. What we often think is important and essential ends up, in a sense, illusions. What's real is what we see in the cross and resurrection of Jesus. So let's talk a little bit about that. I just put this together for the Deacon newsletter that we do. I'm just doing a little series on the historical Jesus. So if you want to take one and pass around, it deals with resurrection. Okay. Obviously, we can't be exhaustive, but at least we can hit some of the high points. First off, we want to raise is, when we talk about resurrection, what are we talking about? It's not simply Jesus living after death. It's about transformation. That's the best word we can use. A transformation in his whole being that took the historical reality of who Jesus is, and the Father transforms him into the new and final state, what theologians call the eschatological state, the final state of our being. And what we use the word resurrection, the church used exaltation or glorification, sitting at the right hand of the Father, as in terms of Jesus' role as now Lord and Judge. So more than simply eternal life or life after death, this is the completion, the final state, if you would, the exalted state, which tells us where we're headed. Resurrection serves as both a revelation event and a promise. The revelation of who Jesus is, but also who we are and who the Father is. You know, who is this God? And we'll talk a little bit more about this, but also who we are meant to be. What is our destiny? What is it we're here for? Is to, as Paul said, Jesus was the first fruits. He's the firstborn of the dead. And that's where we're all promised to head, resurrection life. That's what our destiny is supposed to be. Well, that changes a whole lot of things. So it's not simply, resurrection is not simply about afterlife, although we tend, obviously, when we talk about that. It's about our destiny. What it is to be a real human being, and what are we here for, and what it is to be God, we find in Jesus, right? Church has struggled for centuries to talk about what we used to call the hypostatic union. You've heard of that, you know, the full humanity and full divinity of Jesus. And the great struggle for church history is to keep those two things together. But some people just want to keep the divinity up front, and we forget the humanity. Or we want to just talk about the humanity of Jesus, which is very popular in today's world, and forget the divinity. But you can't do that. It's not true to the historical Jesus himself, and how, you know, he seems to have understood himself and how things worked out, as we see. But it also misses the point of, number one, who God is and who we are. So let's step back a little bit about this. First of all, in order to understand resurrection, we have to assert that Jesus did die. He died a physical death. And I know for some of us that's obvious, but not for everyone. It was an early heresy at the time in the early church. There were two groups. One were the Gnostics and the others were the Docetists. They had maintained that Jesus only appeared to die. And only appeared to suffer. Why? Because the divine can't suffer. The divine is what they call impassible. And yet, the early church said, no way. So the Gospel of John locks horns with that particularly, doesn't he? Remember, if you look at the beginning of the Gospel of John, it says the Word was made flesh. You know what the word is there? Sarx. You know what sarx means? Meat. That's as earthy as it gets, folks. Right? John was saying, oh no, Jesus just didn't appear to be human. He was human as well as divine. We have to keep those two things in balance. And what's important about that, and we had all these controversies through the early parts of the church for hundreds of years. We kind of forget there was hundreds of years we were going through this discussion. And St. Athanasius put it best. He said, what is not assumed is not saved. So if there's anything about our humanity that God has not assumed in his own being, then we're not saved. So everything about us, God is concerned about. That's the whole point. God is taking us to a place where all this, our total person, is going to be transformed. It's not just about afterlife. It's about the totality of all creation. Everything God's created will be transformed. So Paul talks about that in Romans 8. You remember, he says, you know, the creation itself is groaning like a woman in labor. Until that point where, you know, we reach that point when everything is glorified. And that's why as Catholics we're very concerned not simply about our own individual lives, but we're in this together. We are community. That's one of the things that people who go through these near-death experiences raise up. We're all connected. They are absolutely convinced of that. There's nothing that happens on the far side of the world that doesn't affect us, even if we don't realize it at the time. There's something we're all clued into. There's this connection through the spirit with everything. You guys remember, what was it? It was the first Star Wars movie. You remember that when Obi-Wan Kenobi says, I feel a tremor in the Force. Or he felt like he, because a whole planet had been destroyed. He was like physically affected. Well, then since that's what they're saying is that in the spirit, we're all connected. There's nothing about us that's, so you may think you don't have an interest in what's going on halfway around the world or in Hartford or wherever, but in the end, it's affecting you. It has an effect on all of us. For us, the risen Christ is in every person, incognito, so to speak, every person I meet, even in myself. And that's probably the hardest person to be hospitable to is often ourselves. So the resurrection experience is certainly much broader than this. One of the things that's a part of the experience is Jesus' own death in surrender. You know, it's one of the things in John that that is brought out quite clearly, that Jesus' life isn't taken from him. Jesus offers this to the Father and to us as gift, as surrender. That's the key to understanding who we are. If you look at Paul's letter to the Philippians, in chapter 2, there's this early Christian hymn he quotes. Though he was in the form of God, you know that he didn't deem equality with God something to be grasped at. Rather, he emptied himself, taking on the form of a slave. And he did this all the way to death on a cross. And that's why God highly exalted him. So resurrection isn't just God pulling the rug out from underneath the Romans and the people who killed Jesus. It is a revelatory moment that the Son, who Jesus truly is Son in this self-sacrificial manner. That this is who God is. You know, this love that goes to giving oneself up completely, and that if we want to know who we are, we follow that same path. And that's probably the harder thing to do as human beings. Isn't that the challenge for us? What we call conversion. Conversion is this letting go of our egotism, our need to be right, our need to be in control of everything, and then begin to follow Jesus' way. That's what leads, what he said, to real life. And you can begin to experience it in the now. John's Gospel says we can begin to experience that right now as we give to the degree that Jesus gave, or at least we attempt to do that. We begin to experience eternal life now in that particular type of activity. The other thing, too, is when you live that way, it's good for your body, believe it or not. Living, going out toward others has a positive effect on who we are physically and emotionally. Trying to maintain ourselves within, being frightened of others, frightened of the world, generally has a very negative effect on us. Spirituality takes a cue from all this, doesn't it? Real spirituality, there's a lot of spirituality being marketed out in the world today. A lot of it is now what we call the gospel of affluence. Have you heard of the gospel of affluence? You know, if you're right with God, you'll own 7 Cadillacs. That sounds familiar. So I remember Reverend Ike. Remember Reverend Ike years ago? It's kind of a thing going on out there that this God is a God of abundance. And abundance is used simply in a material sense in many ways. Yeah, God's the God of abundance. It doesn't mean it's going to be material. Material things can get in my way of real faith and get in the way of my spiritual growth. What's central to our spirituality, or any authentic spirituality in terms of the world religions even, is the cross, right? You know, Hinduism may not have a cross, but it understands that the way to true spiritual union with God has to go through what they call a stripping process. You familiar with that term, stripping? All the illusions of your life get stripped away. All the things you've invested so much in are shown to be illusions in your life. They mean nothing, they give you nothing. They've actually caused great distress in your life. The minute you begin to move through that, it can be very difficult because you like those illusions. That's where my safety is. That's where my identity is. Richard Rohr published an interesting book called, I think it's Falling Up. I don't know if you're familiar with Richard Rohr's stuff. Rohr says that, you know, before 50, what is your life about? Building your resume, right? Success, career success, awards, recognition, all the things that flatter the ego. And we say, okay, I'm really making it. But we hit that time in our life when we look back and say, why was I doing that again? We begin to think about who I am, where am I going, what's this all meaning again? We may have been playing with those questions all along, but we tend to kind of push them away. Now they kind of impose themselves on us at a certain time in our lives. And we begin to see that much of that was a way of making a living, but it's not really what I'm about. And that's okay. I mean, you got to do that in life. You got to build your life. You got to provide for your family. But we know it's not enough. And then we go through that journey up the cross where we move toward being completely vulnerable to others and God, and that's hard. Because our whole lives we've tried not to be. And we've done everything we could not to be vulnerable. We don't like our vulnerability. But that's what Jesus is showing us. As we try to protect ourselves too much, we never grow. Real spiritual life has to go through this sort of crucifixion of our egotism and begin to understand that the real person of who we are can let go of that stuff. And then we live in that kind of freedom that Paul talks about. The freedom of the children of God is one where we're not encumbered by those kinds of things. Imagine just living in that fashion where you don't live your life in dread and stress and fear, but in this freedom of loving, of simply giving out. I mean, it's sort of like what we saw with Gordon Allen. His life changed tremendously. You know, he's no longer out to make the hit and be a great tycoon. Now he's interested in people. That's his centerpiece, helping in whatever way he can. The resurrection of Jesus, well, number one, it vindicates Jesus' ministry in person, doesn't it? Jesus was saying, I have a relationship with the Father in a particular sense. This is the way I've called my followers to live. And Jesus is raised. Of all people in history, a proclamation about someone who is raised was not who they expected. It wasn't Caesar. It wasn't the great world conquerors. It was someone who died accursed on a cross. I mean, according to Jewish law, if you died on a cross, you died accursed of God. And you can understand why the apostles, aside from Jesus dying, have had to grapple now with this reality. How did it happen? We thought he was the one. Remember in Emmaus, they're talking, what happened here? How could we have been so wrong? Well, they weren't wrong. You know, Jesus is raised, and that really turns a lot of things on their head in terms of who God is, who we are, you know, who Jesus is. Obviously, he's validated. The other piece about this is God is sending a message to us. Whenever God acts in history, if you look at these scriptures of the Old and the New Testament, there is a pattern of death and resurrection that goes through the scriptures, and it's based on promise and fulfillment. You remember what they were promised when they were in bondage. People of Israel, I will send a liberator. What happens? Sent a liberator. Another promise comes down, I will send my prophets will come. The prophets come, talking about God, and that God will do something in the future for them. The promise of the Messiah comes, and it's a fulfilled promise, but another promise comes. Upon the resurrection of Jesus, what are they looking forward to afterward? His return. There's something yet to come. It's another promise. So this is a God of promise and fulfillment. And that fulfillment, as we said before, is not simply that we're all going to be individually taken up into a new life, but the entire creation. That nothing is lost to God. I think it's important for us to recognize. And that's very important when we deal with people who have suffered great loss. I taught at Holy Cross High School for 16 years. And you remember Storm Gloria. It was a hurricane that came up the coast in 1985, really did a lot of damage in the state. One of the teachers I worked with, her daughter went outside after the storm. She's 8 years old. Her father was cutting down trees with a saw, all the limbs that had come down. They didn't know she had gotten out of the house. It happens with children, as you know, you turn your back. She was going by one of these trees that had fallen, and what happened is the tree all of a sudden kicked out, hit her right here, and killed her. And the parents were there to see that. The mother tried to come back. It took many years for her to finally get to the point where she could admit she was devastated. She put on a good front for a long time. She got involved in her church, head over heels, a lovely lady, but you could see she hadn't quite dealt with it. Finally, she started to deal with it, that sense of aloneness, that sense of frustration, anger. What does a parent think? I'll never see my child. grow up. I'll never see my child graduate. I'll never see my child get married. And we sat down one time and I said, you know, I know these are things which go through parents' minds. All of us who have children, that's our greatest dread. And I said, but you know what? Based upon what our faith says, somehow God makes that all right somehow. And are they there waiting for you to say, all those things you thought you missed, we're going to get to live those. We're going to have to do that together. I think when you think about this too, with resurrection faith, how powerful this is in terms of the fact that we have been talking, as a Catholic church, we've been struggling with a culture. No matter where someone comes down on the abortion issue in this country, we have to admit the fact that 55 million abortions since 1973 is catastrophic. You know, was there 55 million lives that somehow will not touch us in some fashion on this earth? We don't know who they were. We know what they could have contributed for good or for ill. Resurrection of Jesus says they're not lost. That God somehow is able to fix these aborted children get another shot somehow, in some way. God does something with them. And I think that's important for the distinctions we're making. Near-death experience is a powerful experience. It has implications for the way we see ourselves in our lives. The world is clearly moving. If you are following the trends and things in the level of science, psychology, and other places, it is clear that materialism, as we know it, that somehow everything is simply chemical processes, is slowly losing its grip. And in some sense, if it isn't dead, it's going to be it's in serious condition right now. And this is happening from mainline science. This isn't happening from fringe people. This is happening too from a number of different experiences where we simply begin to understand our spiritual natures again. It seems as though we've been kind of like in a Babylonian exile in the West for some time when it came to our kind of spiritual reality of who we are. It was okay to be religious as long as it was just your gig and so on. But we don't have, if you look at the public discourse in our nation right now, we don't really know how to talk about it very well, do we? I mean, we don't know how to talk about God intelligently in the public discourse. In a church setting, yes. But in the general culture, we don't have these discussions. What's provoking it is these types of things that are going on. Little by little, people are saying, okay, we've got to look at this. This isn't just happening to people who have religious faith. This is happening to non-believers. It's happening to children, adults, every profession we know. And it's impacting on people and making significant changes. The experience of the risen Jesus, of course, for us is what's important. In the early church, what convinced them of Jesus' resurrection? It wasn't the empty tomb. The empty tomb certainly has something to say to us. And scholars will debate whether or not it was historical or not. I mean, nobody can seem to get together on this. But there's something to be said about the fact that an empty tomb just proves one thing. The tomb is empty. Doesn't prove a resurrection. What proves the resurrection of Jesus to the early church is himself making himself known to them. On his initiative, he goes and shows them and reveals himself to them. And that changes people. Obviously, it had an effect on them to the point where these frightened people who feared for their lives as well, they all knew what crucifixion was about. They had seen thousands of them. Okay? And they didn't want any part of it. But whatever the experience was like for them, and the scriptures tell us it was of a nature which is hard to really pin down, it changed them. And they became fearless proclaimers of the gospel. Or at least, even if they were afraid, it did not deter their behavior. They continued to go out. They were willing to take great risks. And as you know, many of them were martyred and killed and ridiculed and so forth. And they accepted a whole new way of life to do this. In some sense, there's a similarity then between these experiences that people are having, right? It changes them too. Some of them, that's all they want to do is talk about the experience. For other people, they've been rather shy because they don't want to be considered nuts. But as I said, more and more people are coming forward to somehow talk about the experience and to say that this has made a tremendous change in my life, but in the end, these experiences are incomplete. The resurrection of Jesus as spiritual reality, who we truly are, has a destiny and a future that we're heading toward, and that God is working with us in some fashion to make happen. NDEs only tell us that perhaps there is a genuine spiritual reality and a life after physical death, some kind of experience. It doesn't tell us where it's all headed. It doesn't tell us the final goal. That's what resurrection. Resurrection is the revelation that we will become like him. That's the concern. That's where our hope comes from. That's where the energy for our mission as church comes from. We're not simply being good to people. We're doing this because this is who we're meant to be. This is who we are. And so everything we do for the good, everything that transforms something from something that's disorganized or damaged to something that's healed, you're already anticipating that future that's coming. So really, when you think about it, we're really people who, while the experience of the risen Christ is with us, there's still something yet to come. So in a way, we're still kind of in an Advent period, aren't we? As historical beings, Christ is coming with the fullness of the kingdom, and yet at the same time, he's present with us, but we're moving toward a particular goal. And that goal is to make this world, one, more human, to make it more peaceful and just. All the things that in some way honors the sacred dignity of every person. That's really what we're about. Why don't we take some questions if you have any, or some confusions or comments or whatever. Because we are at 10 of 9 and I want to just save a little more time. If you have any comments or anything you want to, you know somebody who went through something, just maybe you can just shoot some out. Anything I didn't cover, you got questions about? Please, someone ask a question. You're paying good money for this.
Is there any explanation to patients who have near-death experiences that they have spontaneous healings of certain diseases in their
bodies? No. Yeah, we're looking explanations in the normal course. No, there's no way to explain that. And many times they're instantaneous. Someone who's got stage 4 cancer all of a sudden, after the experience, it's gone. Or people are healed of physical maladies they once had. It's one of the things about this experience I need to say, too, is that people who experience those who've already passed on, and they see them, they're not the age they were when they died, usually. They're usually young, vital. If they were, you know, if they had lost a limb, or all that's gone. I know one woman who went there, when I was talking about Sarah, who had the 16 operations afterwards, she met her father, who in life was a schizophrenic and an alcoholic. And the two things, you know. He was not, her experience of him that was, he was 30 years old, svelte. You know, I feel good about that. I'm looking forward to the fact I'm gonna look like I did at 25, you know, 50 pounds lighter and more hair.
Does the church actually have any theological views on
near-death
experiences?
No, the church is, it's really kind of maintained respectful distance, because how do you really wade into a discussion?
The theologians are talking about it.
Yeah, they just would say the same thing, that while this may be, I think what Monica Helwig said is probably appropriate. These are compelling, but the best we can come to is perhaps they do suggest continuing consciousness after physical death. The rest, we don't know what to say about. We, of course, would maintain our particular, you know, position of resurrection faith. That's why I wanted to bring these two topics together, because you really can't extrapolate from those experiences to say where the final goal is with those. You know, everyone's going to have an opinion on their experience. What we're saying, ultimately, is Jesus is distinct from the folks who've had these experiences as the Son, because he has attained the final state. That's what resurrection is, the final state. We would say these folks are kind of in between, perhaps, states, or not completed yet. So even with that, I mean, even the Catholic notion of purgatory says there's still some work to be done with you kind of you know, getting in shape, so to speak. Yeah.
And that God has, has use for them. I mean,
well, we don't maintain this. We don't, as Christianity as a whole, we don't accept reincarnation as a possibility, at least in our teaching. But in the end, it's not our call. A different existence, perhaps. It doesn't have to be our corporeal existence. It could be a different kind of existence for children that have been aborted, or anyone who's died as a young child, or what we consider not leading a life. We just don't, we have no actual explanation for that. We kind of leave that to God. But we're confident that nothing is lost to God. So, a person, in a sense, isn't cheated out of a life. That's all I'm saying. It looks that way to us here. And people should be allowed to continue their lives here without interference of people taking their lives, like we saw in Boston, or like we've seen in Sandy Hook, or when we see people, war and the rest of it. But we're saying God is not constrained by our limitations. And reincarnation is not a Christian thing. Some people who've had these experiences will say that they felt maybe that was a possibility, but not all of them do. And some of them would say, if it is, it's under really interesting, they just don't have a clear sense of that. And I think if you're in an Eastern culture, you tend to have an experience of this along the lines that you're familiar with. That's one of the things, that it does have cultural symbols that are attached to the experience. It's the way we interpret what we're going through. It's the only way we can make sense of it in a human sense. When we come back to talk about it, we often use our symbols to communicate what we went through. So in an Eastern person, you would probably get an experience of what they would expect to have happen to them. But even though there's distinctions, there's this core sense of that we've talked about here. The basic characteristics seem to hold across cultures and across socioeconomic classes and religious traditions and so forth. But if you're in a particular, say, Christian tradition, many people will identify the spiritual being as Jesus or the Blessed Mother. I had one woman, she was a child, she went through this, she was having her tonsils out, and they used ether back then, and evidently the guy used too much. She went out of her body, she said she was watching this, and then she went through this beautiful, went through this tunnel and came out to this beautiful landscape, and there was this beautiful woman there. And many children will talk that way, who've never had any religious training, and they'll say, this woman, this beautiful woman met me. Some will name her Elizabeth, others will say it's the Blessed Mother, whatever. But people seem to get an experience where they're made to feel at ease with familiar markers. That's all I can tell you. That's one of the things that mystifies us, is that whatever it is, it's to communicate to the person the way they can understand. So you're not going to get something that doesn't make any sense to you. That would not be the point. Everyone who comes back says, I got what I needed in this, whatever it was, whatever void in my life there was, or some misunderstanding or pain in my life was healed. Often fractured relationships, they understood why their parents were the way they were, and that means they can start all over again. Let's face it, we all grew up in homes with dysfunction, right? It's just a matter of degree. Some are severely dysfunctional, but what happens is many people got insight into why their parents were the way they were, and all that made all the difference. They now were able to be compassionate with them and understand them, that they were struggling, that they came from tough situations, and so on. So, many people, they walk away with this insight and so on, which is really uncanny. That's the thing that's so striking about this. Culturally, there's a similarity in all the experiences, no matter where you are. But there is the distinction of the markers. There's things that people can feel help them to understand what they just went through. So if you're a Catholic, you may meet Jesus and the Blessed Mother. If you're a Protestant, probably not Mary. Not that Mary wouldn't want to show up and help, it's just, it's not in the category of that child, perhaps, or that person, that's all. And yet again, Children have experiences where one child met the Heavenly Father, she said, and Jesus, and they were not a Christian family. So where she got this, no one knows. She was only 4 years old. She had drowned in a pool. And if he was talking to her doctor, the doctor says, tell me what happened. He was just asking her, what happened to you? She came out with this story, practically fell off his chair. Dr. Melvin Morse is his name. He's a pediatrician, and he is plunged into this hook, line, and sinker, and he's convinced something genuine is going on here. This is not a brain phenomenon for him. Just too many unanswered questions. I obviously can't be as comprehensive. It would take a whole semester to go through the literature and all the things that are going on. But there's some books I could advise which I consider to be trustworthy. How can I put it that way? The one by Pim Van Lommel was good. Life Beyond, Consciousness Beyond Death. That's fairly new. It came out about a year and a half ago. A good scientific study, and he's convinced that we are spiritual beings now. He was a materialist before he got involved with this, as was actually Aben Alexander. I don't know if you're familiar. He really had pretty much bought the materialistic paradigm, and with that experience, that's out the window now for him. He sees obviously spirit transcends matter and so forth. Okay. Any other questions before we go? Well, I want to thank you all for having me out here. I liked having pizza, first of all. It's a great meal. Good excuse to have it, too, since I've been having it lately. And I want to thank Lou for inviting me and you all taking the time to come out and hopefully